This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast.
Hi, Tanya.
How are you today?
Today's a great day. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to tell everyone this latest story. So welcome back, everyone. Before I get into it, though, if you could hit the subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to, that would be great. So, Talia, are you ready?
Yeah, and I just want to take a second to thank everybody for taking time out of their day to listen to us. We really appreciate you guys more than you know.
Absolutely. I second that. 42-year-old Kimberly Cates woke up in the early morning hours in her bedroom on September 4th, 2009. She thought she heard her 11-year-old daughter, Jamie, coming into her bedroom. The Cates family consisted of Kimberly, her husband David, and Jamie, and they all lived in the charming little New Hampshire town of Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon is a rural town of about 2,000 people near the Massachusetts-New Hampshire border. The home they lived in was on a rather isolated street, and they didn't really have any close neighbors, but there were some other houses on the street.
That's how my house is.
Yeah, they're spaced. Kimberly's husband and Jamie's father, David, was out of town on business. Kimberly and Jamie were home together alone, or so they thought.
Oh, shit.
I know. In the dark, Kimberly called out to Jamie. Jamie, is that you? Jamie was laying in the bed next to her mom and responded, yes, mom.
Well, I think if she's in the bed next to her.
I know.
It might not be her making the sound, right?
Yeah, maybe. Probably.
Oh, you know.
I know. Kimberly reached for her bedside lamp to turn it on. However, instead, she and Jamie were violently attacked by two men standing on either side of her bed. The man attacking Kimberly was 17-year-old Steven Spader, and he was attacking her with a machete.
A machete?
A machete. He was swinging the machete with all of his strength, almost like a baseball bat, hacking Kimberly with it. Kimberly begged him to stop, telling him, you don't have to do this. Please stop. On the other side of the bed was Christopher Gribble, 19, and he was wielding a knife. When Steven savagely cut Kimberly with the machete, Chris was stabbing Jamie with his knife. During the attack, Kimberly tried to console her daughter, telling her everything was going to be okay.
Doesn't sound like it.
No. Unfortunately, everything was not going to be okay. Chris continued attacking Jamie, trying to puncture her heart and kill her. With each stab, he grew angrier. Why won't she just die? And in his frenzied anger, he picked Jamie up and threw her across the room, her body slamming into a sliding glass door and crumpling to the floor like a discarded doll, entangled in the curtains of the window. In Chris's final act, he grabbed Kimberly by her hair and pulled her head back and slit her throat with his knife. Moving out of the bedroom, Chris and Steven slashed Jamie one last time, and they were satisfied she was dead because she just didn't move. When they left, Jamie, who was miraculously still clinging to life, stumbled to the kitchen where she called the police. Can you imagine?
Wow, I'd be so afraid if I was her.
I'd be terrified to even move. She waited for the police, blood-soaked, terrified, and trying to just make sense of what just happened to her and her mother. The medical examiner determined Kimberly had suffered 32 blows from the machete.
Damn!
I know. It's a lot. Her skull was split open. Her left eye socket was basically non-existent, and actually her eyeball had been ejected from the socket due to the severity of the blows. Several of her organs had been pierced or cut by the machete, and some of her bones were hacked to tiny pieces. The coroner said that Kimberly died from the loss of blood and not a fatal stab wound. This means she felt every injury she had before finally succumbing to death.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
I know, this was a terrible attack. Jamie survived her injuries by playing dead. She survived even though they were extensive. So extensive, she spent 2 weeks in the hospital to recover.
How many stab wounds did she have?
She was stabbed 18 times, all over her body. Her left foot was partially severed.
Oh, shit.
I know, and she even lost part of it permanently. She was disfigured. Her skull was also split open, and she had a shattered jaw.
How she managed to call 911 and talk with a shattered jaw?
I know, I can't even imagine, right? She was just running on adrenaline, I'm sure of it.
Wow. She's way tougher than me.
Me too. I honestly probably would have laid there the whole time.
I would have laid there and died.
Mm-hmm. Right? I would have been terrified. I mean, in the middle of the night, sometimes when you hear a noise, I'm like, I freeze.
I'm sure it's a serial killer.
I know.
Every time.
Exactly. A couple of years before this attack, in 2007, during Stephen Spader's sophomore year of high school, and Stephen was the one with the machete, his friends began to notice some strange and dark behavior from him.
I bet.
He had been in and out of drug abuse programs, including one located in Utah, for his problems with marijuana and speed. He shaved his head and burned and cut his own skin. He also talked frequently about suicide. And a friend of his said he always thought Stephen would kill himself before he ever killed anyone else. A couple years later, Stephen decided he wanted to start a group with some of his friends.
What kind of group?
Well, he called it a brotherhood, but it was more like an anarchist group. So he just wanted to raise some hell. He had recently dropped out of Brookline High School and still hung out with some of his friends. Stephen called the brotherhood the Disciples of Destruction.
I swear I listened to that band in the 80s.
It's a great name for a band. Or DOD for short. And he created written goals and bylaws for DOD. He was serious.
The Disciples of Destruction.
The Disciples of Destruction. Loyalty and brotherhood are key themes that ran throughout the documents he wrote up. Stephen elected himself president.
That's the best.
I know.
I'm the perfect person for the job. Me.
And it's not a democracy. We are not going to have an election. And he named two of his friends, William, who I'm going to call Billy, Marks, and Quinn Glover, as officers. A third friend, Christopher Gribble, the one who attacked Jamie, was also a member of DOD.
Did he get to be an officer?
I don't think so.
He didn't make rank yet?
He didn't make rank. Stephen attempted to recruit a fourth friend. His name was Autumn Savoy.
What kind of a name is Autumn for a boy?
A boy named Autumn. As a member of DOD, but Autumn declined. But he did help Stephen create a logo for DOD.
Does the logo have skulls and fire?
You think it would. But no, it's quite boring. It is just a backwards capital D, a little O, and then a capital D.
Wow.
They need a better branding.
That's disappointing.
I know.
They need some guns and flames and skulls.
They really did. One of the main goals of DOD was to make money, most likely through illegal means, mainly breaking and entering into local homes. During that fall, Stephen talked a lot to the members of DOD about how he not only wanted to break into homes and steal shit, but he also was fantasizing about murdering the occupants. He told them he wanted to use chloroform in order to incapacitate the victims and then tie them up, so they could easily be moved to other locations in the home in order to be tortured for financial information. On October 2, 2009, a couple days before Kimberly and Jamie were attacked, Stephen bought a knife to further this plan. The next day, October 3rd, Billy also bought a knife from the same store. Stephen told Autumn that he was going to do a quote-unquote job, which was going to be an initiation mission for the four members of DOD. Autumn took the meaning of the word job to mean that Stephen was planning to break into a home and rob it. That same day, Stephen and Chris used Autumn's computer to search the internet on how to make chloroform. And Stephen told Autumn he needed chloroform to carry out a robbery.
Why?
Right? This was all during the same conversation they had about doing a job. So this was all one conversation. Stephen determined after searching how to make chloroform that he needed ice, bleach, and acetone.
That's it?
That's it.
You just go down to Walmart and get that.
Right? I know. I didn't think it was so easy to make chloroform. I mean, I don't have measurements or anything, but...
We don't want the FBI knocking on the door.
No, we don't.
Don't give any recipes away.
During one of these 2 days, Chris, who didn't purchase a knife like Stephen and Billy did, he took a machete and a knife belonging to his dad. The following day, the day of the crime, October 4th, Stephen and Quinn had a text conversation. Stephen persuaded Quinn into joining him in the home invasion that they had previously discussed and told Quinn to bring certain items with him. The items he wanted Quinn to bring were the ingredients needed to make chloroform. At the very start of the text conversation, Stephen made it clear that this was a crime to be done on behalf of DOD and their brotherhood.
Oh, stop it.
Stephen asked Quinn to bring the ingredients to make chloroform because Chris had tried to get acetone from his girlfriend and mother but was unsuccessful. Chris texted Stephen about not being able to get it and asked, like, can we just get it from Walmart?
Yes, you can.
You can. They sell acetone. Chris had lied to his mom about why he needed the acetone and told her that he needed it to clean a knife. Why she was okay with that, I don't know.
Why you need to clean a knife?
Right?
The hell?
What the hell? In that same text conversation between Chris and Stephen, they talked about going to a, quote, party, end quote, and discussed plastic garbage bags, gloves, and needing an extra set of clothing and bringing it to the party.
Is party code for break-in?
That's what I believe. Such a complicated code, Talia.
They're very sophisticated.
Very, very sophisticated.
All through text.
Yeah, all
That's
through text.
The best.
I'm sure no one will figure out what they mean. The night the boys went to carry out the home invasion, Stephen drove them in his car, and he announced to all of them that what they were doing was going to be an initiation for the members of DOD as a way to prove their devotion. Stephen said, quote, we're about to do the most evil thing this town has ever seen, end quote, as they drove to Kimberly Cates' isolated home on Tro Road. Her home was chosen at random because it was so isolated. They drove up and down the street several times to make sure that this was the house they wanted to hit. They actually originally decided to attack the house next door, which I'm thinking must have been the house down the street, but decided at the last minute that it was just too big.
Aren't they concerned that there might be pit bulls or Rottweilers or a bunch of men in the house?
Apparently this
They're
never...
They're going to get their ass kicked.
Right. They never thought of it or weren't concerned with it or thought that because they were the disciples of destruction.
Do it again. That sounded great. It's like Pantera right in front of me.
That they would have their badass knives and machetes and who knows. Right? I would be afraid.
They're stupid teens.
Before they went into the home, they cut the electricity to it. They attempted to get in through two different ways. First, they tried to get in by breaking a basement window, through which Billy crawled. Then they removed the, I believe, air conditioning unit from one of the windows, and Stephen crawled through that. When he got into the house, he opened the back door for the others and let them in. Once inside the home, they found an iPod in Jamie's room, and they used that as a flashlight because in all of this planning, they didn't think to bring flashlights.
Stop it.
Even though they cut the electricity and it's pitch black in the house.
I'm not in the mood for stupid today.
I know you.
Just stop.
How bright can that iPod possibly be?
You got machete, ingredients for chloroform, but you don't bring a fucking flashlight. Too much.
Too much. Using the light from Jamie's iPod, they came upon Kimberly's bedroom door. As they approached the door, Chris and Stephen had their weapons out and were the first to go through the door leading the attack. As Stephen and Chris murdered Kimberly and attacked Jamie, Billy stood in the doorway and just watched. He just stood there. Quinn walked away from the bedroom with his hands over his ears and went into the living room while the murders occurred and could overhear the screams, cries for help, and then the thud of Jamie being flung across the room. He heard Kimberly say, "Jamie, run!" So he just heard everything.
But he didn't stop it.
But he didn't stop it, and neither did Billy. When Stephen left the bedroom, there was blood and hair on the machete that he was carrying. Both Billy and Quinn claim to this day they had no idea Stephen and Chris were going to kill the home's inhabitants.
Mm-hmm. They just brought machetes, what, to whack the weeds on their way into the house?
Whack the weeds, I know. I have no idea. It's such a shitty plan that, I don't know, I just don't get it. They thought they were just there to rob. Because that's okay. Before leaving, DOD made off with some of the Cates' personal property. They left with one of David's old wallets, a pearl necklace, two wooden jewelry boxes, and they took Jamie's iPod with them. Several hours later, Chris pawned their haul from the home at the local Cash for Gold. Guess what Kimberly's life was worth?
Whatever you're going to say is going to piss me off.
I know, because I'm pissed. It was a whopping $130. When the Mount Vernon residents woke up to the horrific news of the attack on Kimberly and Jamie, the police had very little clues to go on. Jamie had seen the attackers, but it was dark, and the only thing she could tell the police was that it was white guys that attacked her and her mom. The police were perplexed. However, luckily, everyone involved in this crime had a big mouth and couldn't keep it shut. By 5:30 a.m., Chris and Stephen had gotten together with Billy and Quinn and went to Autumn's house. Just because Autumn refused to become a member of DOD didn't prevent him from getting involved after these murders were complete.
I prefer you say Disciples of Destruction.
Okay.
Disciples of Destruction.
Just like that. Okay, continue. Just like that every time.
Okay, every time.
I find it very entertaining.
And hopefully everybody else does too.
You should have been in a band, Tanya. Heavy metal is your calling.
Right. Could you see me in a band? Come on, Talia. I don't have the face for a heavy metal band. Stephen and Chris recruited Autumn for a different mission. He needed to help them cover up the crime. They first wanted to make sure he would provide all of them with an alibi for that overnight by saying that they were spending the night at his house. The boys were just having a slumber party, Talia.
The
Disciples of Destruction.
We're having a slumber party. Okay.
Then Stephen, Chris, and Autumn got rid of the bloody clothing and shoes that the four were wearing when they committed the heinous crime. They also disposed of some of the stolen items as well, dumping them in the Nashau, might be saying that wrong, river, such as the empty jewelry boxes and David's empty wallet. After disposing of the evidence, Stephen and Chris left Autumn's house and went home to get some much-needed sleep.
Yeah, they're tired.
Yeah, they're tired after, you know, murdering someone.
Is the pawn shop open 24 hours a day?
Right, he went early in the morning, you're right. Maybe.
I don't know. It's been a while.
Oh, who knows? When they woke up later in the day, Chris and Stephen rendezvoused with another friend at his house. His name was Kyle Fenton, and that was around 5:30 p.m. They met at Kyle's house to discuss and relive the previous day's murderous events. I don't know why they got Kyle involved, but it's a good thing they did. Because as the three were discussing what happened, thinking that they were alone and could talk freely, enjoying the privacy of Kyle's house, while they were doing that, Kyle's mom was listening.
Absolutely. Snooping on the teens.
Mm-hmm. Can't let them get away with shit. Totally freaking out and afraid her son was involved in the crime somehow or would be implicated as an accomplice or worse. Kyle's mom went to the Amherst, New Hampshire Police Department and gave them quite the story. She actually helped break the case wide open and helped to get justice for Kimberly and her family. When Stephen was arrested, he seemed like an unlikely ringleader. He was quiet, aloof, and someone who wrote inside one of his sweatshirts, This is Steven's sweatshirt. Steven, who is awesome.
He wrote that?
Yeah.
In his own sweatshirt?
In his own sweatshirt.
Okay.
He just seemed like a kid, right? He didn't seem like someone who would go on to brag about how he woke Kimberly Cates up in her bed with a machete blow to her head. Eventually, as I mentioned, Steven gets arrested, but so do Chris, Quinn, Billy, and Autumn. While he was incarcerated, Steven wrote to a fellow inmate at the Hillsborough County Jail's maximum security section. His name was Chad Landry.
Was this a new friend he met?
It was a new friend he met, yes.
And he's writing him something.
Yes.
In jail because of all the privacy he's got there too.
Well, you can't talk. Somebody might hear it.
Oh, yeah, slip him a note.
I mean, he got busted because Kyle's mom overheard what he was saying.
He's learned his lesson. He's going to write it down now.
Absolutely, write it down. He told Chad about the Disciples of Destruction.
Oh, that's amazing when you do that.
And how it related to the charges he was facing. He said, quote, "So Billy, Chris, and Quinn knew that I've been about the bodies, and all three wanted to kill someone. Personally, I was considered starting a crew, not a gang, but a group of like-minded individuals," and that phrasing just cracked me up for some reason, "with the balls to do crazy shit. I didn't want pussies or people who just talk the talk, dig? So I set this up to see if my homies could be about it. I guess I thought wrong," end quote. A handwriting expert would testify at Stephen's trial that this letter that described every detail of the murder, as well as how they prepared.
So it was longer than what you read?
Yeah, it was longer than what I read. I mean, it just spilled the beans on everything. That handwriting expert testified that it was indeed Stephen's handwriting. Stephen's defense tried to do damage control regarding that letter, saying Stephen, while he did write the letter to brag about the crime, he did it because he wanted attention, not because he actually did it.
Mm-hmm. Stop it.
Polish that turd, Talia.
Stop it.
You know our jobs, we have to polish turds sometimes.
That's one of the pleasures of being a lawyer. Got a case that's a pile of shit.
Yeah, got to make it shine. Quinn spilled his guts at Stephen's trial. Quinn actually took a plea deal that I'll tell you about a little bit later, but...
Smart kid.
Right, absolutely. He told the gruesome plot that Stephen had cooked up, breaking into homes of unsuspecting people, rob them, and then murder them. Stephen really wanted to stage the bodies, too, in some sort of outrageous statement meant for some sort of sick notoriety. Stephen also talked about wanting to stay overnight in the victim's home. He talked about putting their heads on stakes and even cannibalizing them, specifically roasting them.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what the hell happened to little Stephen?
I know, he's going
to
slow roast people, what?
What the hell? Man.
Sickos.
Sick bastard.
Stephen was fascinated by the Zodiac Killer.
I am too.
Aren't we all? All of us true crime fans, I think, are. And he asked Quinn what he knew about the still unknown killer. Stephen was fascinated by the Zodiac Killer because he chose his victims at random and killed them quickly, leaving behind very little evidence. And I think he tried to emulate that, but it doesn't really go with the idea that he wants to stay overnight and roast someone and do all this complicated shit. But whatever. Quinn described Stephen's behavior immediately after the attacks as being euphoric and excited. He said, quote, "It was like he had just gotten off a roller coaster," end quote.
That's not surprising.
No. He remembers Stephen saying, quote, "We just broke up a family. Isn't that great?" End quote.
Oh, man.
You know, what an asshole.
I need to bitch slap him.
Somebody does. While Quinn was giving this testimony, Stephen would crack his knuckles and just stare at him, to which Quinn would just stare back.
Yeah, he's the one with the plea deal. Fuck you, Stephen.
Right, exactly. Quinn insisted in his testimony that he didn't know until the moment it happened that Chris and Stephen were serious about wanting to kill the inhabitants of the home.
Nope. Don't believe it.
However, Quinn admitted that he brought a knife with him to the Cates' house. And when he went back home, he stored the knife in a ripped-up teddy bear of his.
How cute.
I know. Before I tell you more, we're going to take a break. Chris's trial was supposed to begin in February 2011. However, he surprised everyone by pleading not guilty by reason of insanity and admitted his role in the savage murder and attack on Jamie. Unfortunately for Chris's lawyers, they were going to have quite the job to prove he was insane.
Yeah, that's a really high threshold.
Mm-hmm. And one of the problems was Chris made remarks about wanting to kill someone for a long time and was disappointed he didn't feel anything after the murder.
You know what most people don't understand is that you not only have to show you're mentally ill, but you have to show that you didn't know right from wrong.
Exactly.
And people can have mental illness and they still obviously know right from wrong.
Right. Yeah. That you don't have the mental capacity to understand it. And Chris totally did. I'm just making my call right now. He said of the killing, quote, "It was kind of cool because it was different. It was a curiosity like, oh, that's what bones look like," end quote. What the fuck?
Just go to a museum.
Right?
What the hell?
Chris's defense weren't successful in convincing the jury that he was insane. He was found guilty of first-degree murder. And in an unprecedented move, the jury asked the judge if they could be present for Chris's sentencing.
Hmm.
I know. As the judge read off his sentence of life without the possibility of parole, many members of the jury looked at Chris with smiling faces.
Yeah, because they're pissed off he was trying to act like he was insane.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it.
Nope. You're going to jail forever. He said of cutting Kimberly's throat, quote, "I moved very carefully from the carotid artery I cut. I had to adjust at one point because I got the angle wrong. I hit the spine. I remember that," end quote. When the judge sentenced him, he said, quote, "Infinity is not enough jail time," end quote, for Chris. Chris told police that his only regret in doing the crime was that he didn't succeed in killing 11-year-old Jamie.
Gosh, he sounds worse than Steven.
I really think he's worse than Steven. He wished he had killed her because he knows that she has to live with what happened. And if he had realized she was still alive, he would have definitely killed her.
What, some act of mercy?
Yeah. Right, I know. It makes no sense. Like, oh, aren't you kind? I mentioned earlier that Quinn accepted a plea deal. He pled guilty to burglary, robbery, and conspiracy to commit burglary. He was sentenced to 20 to 40 years.
Oh.
It was a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
But he was looking at, like, murder charges. It seemed that the judge took some sort of pity on him by accepting his plea because he said that Quinn seemed to appear quite remorseful. Quinn was paroled for the burglary charge in 2017, but because his sentences were consecutive for the other crimes, he won't be getting out anytime soon. At his parole hearing, the board members said they were impressed with his record in prison. They said, quote, "It appears you've been making substantial progress and have been of no disciplinary concern," end quote.
But we're going to keep you.
We're going to keep you. You got to serve out those other sentences. Quinn told the board he had been working on becoming a better person or a changed man trying to make amends. He said, quote, "I try to treat every person I meet with respect, the honor and the care that I owe to them for what I've taken. I'm truly sorry, and there's no words to express the extent of such," end quote.
I can respect that.
Right. Me too. He began serving his second sentence in March 2017 and is eligible for parole for that charge in 2024. The earliest he could be fully released after serving his third sentence is 2029. William Marks, Billy, he also took a plea deal. In exchange for 30 to 60 years.
Holy shit.
I know. Billy pled guilty to conspiracy to commit murder, accomplice to first-degree murder, and conspiracy to commit burglary. However, the judge in the case wouldn't accept the plea.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. He said it, quote, "did not satisfy the goal of sentencing, which includes deterrence, rehabilitation, and segregation from the community."
30 to 60 years.
That's not enough. Billy withdrew his guilty plea, though he did honor the deal he made with prosecutors to cooperate. in the prosecution of Stephen and Chris. For his role in trying to help Chris and Stephen hide the murder from the police after the fact, and for providing an alibi for Stephen and Chris, Autumn Savoy pled guilty to hindering the prosecution and conspiracy in exchange for 5 to 12 years sentence. And he testified against Stephen.
Man, the prosecutor wasn't playing around.
Mm-mm. He was coming down hard on all these guys. Autumn was granted parole in 2015, so he is out of prison. Prior to his parole, the parole board told him he needed to better prepare, like make a plan for when you're released. Once he attended his parole hearing, they were satisfied with his plan, and it was to live with his parents and work 2 jobs at restaurants at a local mall. During the hearing, Autumn said that he didn't know Chris and Stephen were planning a killing spree and only knew about the burglary part of the plan. His mother told the board that Chris and Stephen threatened to kill Autumn and his family if he told anyone about what had happened. A member of the board told him, you know, you're really going to be under intense scrutiny during parole. And Autumn said he wanted to do his best. He wanted to be exemplary and just do everything by the book. He admitted that he believes his problems stemmed from drugs. And while he no longer has a drug problem, he said that his parole conditions should include an evaluation to see if he needs drug abuse counseling. A friend of the Cates family, Christopher Lussier, said after Autumn's parole hearing, he didn't forgive Autumn, but said that he'd been given another chance at freedom and that he should, quote, do something with it, be productive, make it count, end quote. David and Jamie Cates chose not to attend Autumn's parole hearing. In the year that Billy and Quinn were supposed to graduate from high school, the Sohegan High School published its annual yearbook, and they got a lot of flack for it. In the yearbook, you can find the smirking faces of Billy Marks and Quinn Glover. David Cates was extremely upset over the fact that they published these photos in the yearbook, and he wrote a letter to the school administration stating, quote, Jamie and our families will survive this slap in the face. But I think the bigger picture is the message that you sent to students by condoning the immoralization of these soulless young men that consciously with intent invaded our home and took my beautiful wife from Jamie and me. The school principal and superintendent of the school released a statement saying they were deeply sorry for any additional heartache the yearbook photos may have caused. Billy Marks' dad, James, said that he had found out the school was going to leave out Billy's photo, and he called the dean of students. And he assured James that Billy's photo was going to be in the yearbook. James said he would have understood if they had taken Billy's photo out and apologized for upsetting David Cates. He said he didn't think the photo in the yearbook would be upsetting and that he was sorry that it was because the last thing he wanted to do was cause the Cates family more pain and suffering. So I told you when Stephen was in jail, he wrote to that inmate, right?
Chad.
Well, he wrote another letter. He wrote an open letter to the citizens of New Hampshire, or as he called them, quote, unformed idiots, end quote.
Oh, shit. Sounds like he's looking in the mirror.
Right? Shut up. No one wants to hear what you have to say. In the letter, he criticized David Cates for opposing the inclusion of Billy and Quinn in their high school yearbooks.
Oh, just stop with the yearbook.
I know. I called it the yearbook scandal. He said, it's not Billy and Quinn's fault that they were arrested and charged with what they were charged with. And yet, through all the struggle, they both are still trying to get an education. I didn't tell you, but Stephen was charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and attempted murder. In Stephen's trial, the jury came back with their verdict on Stephen's 19th birthday. Guilty. Guilty of first-degree murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to burglary, and witness tampering. He was sentenced to life without parole, as well as an additional 76 years for the attempted murder of Jamie. The judge, and this judge was the judge in all of these cases, it was the same man, he made the sentences consecutive and not to run concurrently, quote, to ensure that you stay in that cage for the rest of your pointless life.
Wow.
He was harsh.
He was pissed.
He was pissed. After Stephen's conviction, his girlfriend gave birth to a baby girl in January of 2010. And these crimes happened in September of 2009. When she was born, Stephen wrote letters to his parents begging them to visit with his daughter and said he would be the best father in the whole world.
No, he wouldn't.
Stephen had to be moved in 2014 to a prison in New Jersey, most likely because he was either attacked or threatened that he was going to be attacked by other inmates. A representative for the prison also told the press that prisoners are moved due to cases being high profile and they need to keep the prison safe. The prison Stephen was moved to in New Jersey was built in 1836 and is one of the oldest prisons in the United States. It's New Jersey's only maximum security prison, and according to its website, houses only the most difficult or dangerous inmates. Chris was moved to a lower security housing unit in the fall of 2013, but was sent back to maximum security within about 3 hours after he moved for being in a fight with another inmate.
That didn't take long.
No. Because of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that sentencing minors to life sentences was unconstitutional, Stephen and Chris were granted resentencing hearings. During Stephen's 2013 resentencing hearing, at which he didn't attend, he told his attorney that he didn't want a reduction in his life sentence, describing himself as the, quote, most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet.
Unquote. Holy shit!
But he's going to be a great dad to Leah.
He's got some self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Introspection, that's impressive.
Right. I don't know if he's bragging, though. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Might be introspection, might be bragging, might be both. In a letter that was read in court by his attorneys, Stephen said, quote, through my impulsive actions, I've torn apart families and ruined lives. But I thought he enjoyed that. That's my note. I am truly sorry for the pain I've caused you. I do not expect forgiveness, nor do I deserve any, end quote.
That was probably written by his attorney.
I know. I'm
just
thinking,
letting the audience know.
I'm like, oh no, I don't know if he wrote that.
Be like, Stephen, let me write that for you.
Here, let me do that. Jamie, who was 14 at the time of the resentencing hearings, was in attendance at court to hear the apology. David and Kimberly's family members said they don't accept Stephen's apology and they find it insulting. The state of New Hampshire determined that Stephen lacked remorse, stating he thought it was unnecessary and a form of weakness to show remorse. They believed that if he got out of prison, he was likely to commit more crimes upon release. So his sentence was upheld, including the extra time, the 76 years. During Chris's resentencing hearing, he asked the court, which consisted of a 3-judge panel, for a reduction in his sentence. And his defense attorney argued that because he was only 19 at the time of the murders, and he had no prior criminal record, sentencing him to life without parole was too harsh. They affirmed his sentence as well. After his sentencing, the New Hampshire legislature included murder during a home invasion to the list of crimes eligible for the death penalty. However, the death penalty in New Hampshire was repealed in 2019. Prisoners who were sentenced to life prior to that ruling had their sentences commuted to life in prison without parole, for which New Hampshire only had one inmate on death row, and he was convicted of killing a police officer in 2016. A funny, somber note to end this section on was that a Republican state senator who backed the bill to abolish the death penalty said of his decision, quote, as I get older, I realize for a fact we're all on death row, and it's just a matter of time before our name gets called.
That's true.
That's true.
But not all of us are going to be electrocuted or injected with something
exactly.
Lethal.
So I'm going to end this by telling you what happened to Jamie. In 2019, WMUR in New Hampshire did a follow-up story about her. She was 21 years old at the time and it had been 10 years since her mother was viciously murdered and she was nearly killed. She was attending college at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she was studying public health, and she played on the field hockey team. When she was interviewed, she was attending the Kimberly Cates Scholarship Tournament, which was named, obviously, in honor of her mom. It's a golf tournament that celebrates the legacy of Kimberly. She was a nurse who was widely loved, and they celebrate her spirit of compassion and caring. The proceeds from the golf tournament go to the Kimberly Cates Memorial Fund, which has given out more than $250,000 in scholarships to students who continue her legacy of helping others. And that is my sad story.
That's really sad. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome. Before we go, I would like to remind everyone to hit the subscribe follow button on your podcast app from which you're listening. If you'd like more information about this episode and our other episodes, please go to our website, tntcrimes.com. There's information on our website as well as on patreon.com/tntcrimes about becoming a member.
So you don't have to listen to the commercials. Nobody wants to listen to commercials anymore.
Right. And you get early release on Fridays instead of Monday.
And we have over 70 episodes commercial free that only the exclusive members get.
And they're good episodes, if I do say so myself.
Pretty raw.
You can find us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram at Hardcore True Crime. Before we go, again, we're going to do shout outs to our newest members.
Shout outs!
Shout outs. So hold your applause.
I'm going to ask everybody to hold their applause.
Until I finish. We would like to thank Alana, Terry, Jennifer, Becky, Stephanie, Frank, Debbie, Maggie, Paige, Robin, Jessica, Christy, Cheryl, Steven, Rihanna, Brittany, Adriana, Katie, Stephanie again, Jennifer, Susan, and Talia's going to finish the list.
But let's not forget Layton, Valerie, Andrea, Carol, Michelle, Lee, Rebecca, Dolly, Tammy, Ashley, Jamie, Lisa, Sindra, Austin, Kayla, Riley, Lee, Tony, Tasha, and Michelle. Yay!
Yay!
You guys are amazing.
You guys are awesome.
I also want to give a shout out to our moderator for our Facebook members only, Katie.
Hey, Katie.
And to Katie, too.
And to Katie, too.
And I want to say a special thanks to my sister, Shayna, who listens to all of our episodes. She's a true crime fanatic like me. Hi, Shayna.
Hi, Shayna. And one last special shout out to Alyssa, who suggested this case for us. If you'd like to suggest a case, please email us at contact@tntcrimes.com.
That's it. Thank you, guys.
All right. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.